So imagine holding like a small gray plastic rectangle.
Okay.
It has this slightly glossy sticker on the front, and it's permanently sealed inside this thick block of clear acrylic.
Right, like a time capsule.
Exactly. And, to most people walking down the street, it's just the dusty relic from 1986. But a few days ago, someone decided that specific plastic rectangle was worth exactly $3 million.
Which is just a staggering valuation. I mean, for a piece of mass-produced consumer electronics.
It really is.
And honestly, it tells us something really profound about how we're, well, how we're currently pricing our own history.
Yeah, and that's exactly why we're jumping into a deep dive today for you. We've got this fascinating stack of late-night tech and gaming analysis from a source called Taken Night.
A really great source, yeah.
It is. And, looking through these reports, there is this massive underlying tension just staring us right in the face.
Oh, absolutely.
We're looking at an industry that's locked in this intense tug of war. Like, on one side, you have its legacy, the things they've built and cherished over the last 40 years.
Right.
And on the other side, you have a future that is demanding entirely new business models and, frankly, entirely new ethical standards from the people actually building it.
Yeah, the rules that kind of governed the technology and gaming sectors since the early 2000s, they're just fracturing.
Completely.
And the friction we're seeing, as these massive companies try to navigate that fracture, it's just incredible to watch.
So we're going to unpack all of this for you today. We're looking at everything from that jaw-dropping $3 million auction price to an existential business crisis at one of the biggest hardware companies in the world.
And a major ethical reckoning happening right now in Silicon Valley, too.
Right, exactly. Because our goal here is to basically cut through the daily noise of tech news and give you the underlying mechanics, the why and the how behind all these shifts.
Yeah. Because the way we value digital experiences and the people who create them is undergoing a fundamental rewrite right now.
It really is. So let's start with that premium on nostalgia. Because on June 12th, Heritage Auctions sold a sealed copy of Super Mario Bros.
For the original Nintendo Entertainment System, right?
Yes, for the NES. And it sold for $3 million.
Wild.
I know. And the sources detail that this is from a very specific second production run in 1986. It's characterized by this glossy label.
Okay.
And it received a PSA grade of 9.6 A++ Rheomac.
Right. And for anyone listening who doesn't, spend their weekends hanging out at auction houses, PSA is basically the gold standard grading system for collectors.
Right.
So a score of 9.6 that basically indicates this cardboard box is practically untouched since it left the factory 40 years ago.
Which is crazy to think about. And they estimate fewer than 50 of these sealed copies even exist in the world.
Yeah. And there's also this persistent rumor floating around in the analysis that the anonymous buyer might actually be Jim Halperin.
Wait, the founder of Heritage Auctions himself?
Exactly. Though, I mean, the ultimate purchaser remained a secret, so we don't know for sure.
That's so interesting. But, looking at this, I just have to ask, is a game still a game if it is permanently sealed in an acrylic case for a billionaire?
That's the million-dollar question, or $3 million question.
Right. Or is it basically just a stock certificate at this point? When I read this, my mind immediately went to like the 2021 NFT
Oh,
bubble.
for sure.
Like, is this $5.2 billion retro gaming market actually sustainable, or are we just watching wealthy people play a really high stakes game of hot potato with plastic?
Well, that tension is basically tearing through the collector community right now. Our source material outlines a very clear bull versus bear case here.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So the bear case argues exactly what you're sensing. It looks like an artificial microeconomy that's just driven entirely by fear of missing out.
Right, FOMO.
Exactly. You have auction houses potentially inflating prices through opaque bidding wars, which is, much like the fine art world.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And functionally, I mean, you can play Super Mario Bros. On your smartphone right now for free. So the physical media is completely divorced from the utility of the art.
Right. The data is everywhere. You aren't buying access to Mario.
Exactly. But then you have the bull case, which relies on this fascinating psychological shift. We really have to look at the demographics here.
Okay.
Millennials are currently in their peak earning years, and they are using their disposable income to literally buy back the artifacts of their youth.
Oh, wow.
But they're treating these items the way older generations treat it, like first edition Hemingway novels.
That is such a good comparison.
Right. A pristine 1986 Mario cartridge is viewed historically as the specific artifact that single-handedly saved the video game industry from the massive market crash of 1983.
Okay, so it's less about the actual game and way more about owning a literal museum piece.
Precisely. It operates a lot like the diamond industry, actually. It relies on artificial scarcity and incredibly strict grading scales to create that value.
Huh.
And the main takeaway from the analysis is that we're seeing a permanent bifurcation in this market.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the genuinely rare museum-quality items with perfect provenance, specifically those with a PSA score above 9.0, those will likely hold their value as cultural artifacts.
Okay, got it.
But the speculative excess surrounding common games, where people are just hoarding unexceptional cartridges hoping to get rich quick, that is almost certainly going to crash.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, okay, that is one way to handle legacy, right? Freeze it in acrylic and trade it like a commodity.
Right.
But what happens when a company takes its most cherished legacy and completely tears it down to rebuild it for a modern audience?
Oh, this is fascinating.
Because just a few days before that auction, Nintendo made a massive announcement on June 9th. They are fully remaking The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, from the ground up.
Yeah, for their upcoming Switch 2 console.
Exactly, launching in late 2026.
And the sources really emphasize that this is a one-to-one rebuild by Nintendo and a development studio called Gritso.
So not just a simple touch-up.
Right. This isn't just taking the 1998 code and, you know, smoothing out the jagged edges.
No, they are rebuilding the entire architecture. For context, for you listening, the original game has a 99 out of 100 on Metacritic.
Which is almost unheard of.
Right. It's an aggregator that combines all critical reviews. It is widely considered one of the most important games ever made, with over 14 million sales.
Yeah.
And Nintendo is adding 4K resolution for televisions, a 1080p handheld mode. It's running at 60 frames per second, full voice acting, a completely re-recorded score by the London Symphony Orchestra, and 5 brand new dungeons.
It sounds incredible.
It does. But looking at the massive resources required to do all this, why take the risk of messing with a masterpiece? Like, why not just leave it alone?
Well, because it's a highly calculated billion-dollar strategic gamble to force hardware adoption, Nintendo operates on a completely different business philosophy than Sony or Microsoft. While their competitors fight over cloud infrastructure and raw processing power, you know, Nintendo uses exclusive, nostalgic software as an impenetrable moat.
Oh, I see. And choosing Ocarina of Time specifically, that bridges multiple generations at once.
It's a masterstroke of demographic targeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, first you have the Gen Xers and older millennials who played it in 1998.
Yeah.
They want that specific childhood feeling back.
Right.
But they want it to look and sound the way their memory pretends it did. Hence the London Symphony and the 4K visuals.
And they are the ones with the disposable income to buy a brand new Switch 2 on launch day.
Precisely. But then on the flip side, you have Gen Z. Millions of them entered the Zelda franchise recently through the massive open world game Breath of the Wild.
Right, which was a huge hit.
Right, so they know the characters and the lore, but they have never experienced the classic linear dungeon puzzle formula. If Nintendo just handed them the blocky 1998 version, you would feel like a massive downgrade. By modernizing the mechanics and adding voice acting, they're translating a 90s design philosophy into a modern language Gen Z will actually accept.
Wow. And the sources project it will sell 8 to 10 million copies in its first year alone.
It's basically a guaranteed system seller.
Yeah, it essentially guarantees that the Switch 2 will have a massive immediate user base. Nintendo is proving that the traditional model, you know, building a proprietary plastic box and making incredible games that you can only play on that specific box, it still works if the software is undeniable.
Which actually brings us to the starkest contrast in the tech landscape right now.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Because Microsoft, specifically their Xbox division, has been running that exact same hardware-exclusive playbook for 25 years. And right now, they are currently facing an existential crisis over it.
The statistics in the Tech and Night report are incredibly grim for a company of that size.
Very grim.
Like, in Japan, the Xbox Series X and S consoles are moving about 1,500 units a week. Wow.
Compare that to the PlayStation 5, which is moving 55,000.
That's a huge gap.
It is. Globally, Xbox's market share is hovering around a stagnant 28%. We've seen them close universally beloved award-winning studios like Arcane Austin and Tango Gameworks just to cut costs.
Yeah, which broke a lot of hearts in the industry.
Definitely. And their flagship subscription service, Game Pass, has just stalled out at 34 million subscribers.
Yeah.
But the detail that really crystallizes this entire situation is a quote from Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella on June 10th.
Oh, I know the quote you're talking about.
He admitted plainly, quote, YouTube makes more money from Xbox games than Microsoft does.
Yeah, that quote is just a breathtaking admission of structural failure.
It really is.
When the content creators making videos about your product are generating more revenue than you are generating by selling the product itself, I mean, the economic model is fundamentally broken.
Totally.
It shows that public interest exists, definitely, but the monetization pipeline is completely bottlenecked.
But wait, I have to challenge this narrative of the Xbox brand dying. Okay, let's hear it.
Because if we look at the software side, their brand new game, Forza Horizon 6, just launched, and the numbers are astronomical.
They really are.
The sources show 6 million players logged in within 48 hours. They hit 300,000 concurrent players on Steam alone, which means 300,000 people were playing at the exact same second on their PC.
Right.
The game is sitting at a 92 on Metacritic. And they finally set the racing festival in Japan. Like, players are drifting down the snowy routes of Mount Fuji and racing through a neon-lit Shibuya crossing at night.
Yeah, it looks gorgeous.
And there's over 550 meticulously detailed cars. So if Xbox is failing, how are they simultaneously releasing one of the highest-rated, most-played games of the entire year?
That paradox is exactly what is driving Microsoft's internal pivot.
Okay.
Forza Horizon 6 proves that Microsoft Studios are still capable of creating world-class premium art. The quality of the content is not the issue here.
So what is?
The issue is the delivery mechanism. A massive hit like Forza is no longer enough to convince millions of consumers to go to a store and spend $500 on a specific piece of Xbox hardware.
Huh. It's like a film studio producing a guaranteed billion-dollar blockbuster movie, but they only allow it to be shown in their own proprietary chain of movie theaters.
Yes.
And consumers are simply refusing to drive out of their way to those specific theaters anymore.
That is the perfect analogy. The art is succeeding, but the infrastructure is acting as an anchor. The fact that Forza had 300,000 concurrent players on Steam, which is, you know, a PC storefront not owned by Xbox, it shows that Microsoft is already relying on non-Xbox platforms to survive.
Right.
The expert consensus is that Xbox is pivoting hard away from being a box under your TV company.
So what do they become?
They're transitioning into a ubiquitous service provider. They want Game Pass to be an app on your smart TV, your phone, and your PC. And crucially, they're shifting to become a multi-platform publisher, meaning they will eventually sell their biggest exclusive games on PlayStation and Nintendo consoles just to reach where the audiences actually are.
That is a massive shift. We just saw how a broken delivery mechanism can drag down great content. But if we want to look at a live service delivery model that is actually thriving, our sources point to a 10-year-old title as the gold standard for sustainability.
Oh, yeah.
It's an asymmetrical horror game called Dead by Daylight.
It is an absolute masterclass in live service economics.
It really is. The game just celebrated its 10th anniversary, which in the gaming world makes it practically a dinosaur.
Oh, completely.
Yet they are maintaining over 150,000 peak concurrent players and have crossed $1.5 billion in total revenue.
Which is huge.
For context, an asymmetrical game pits one incredibly overpowered player, the killer, against a team of four vulnerable players trying to escape. And they just announced two massive content additions that will basically keep the revenue flowing.
Yeah. The first being the arrival of Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th franchise on June 16th.
Which is a massive deal, because Jason has been locked in this bitter, decade-long legal battle over character rights that prevented him from appearing in any media.
Right, it's a huge mess.
So bringing him in cements Dead by Daylight as the definitive interactive horror museum. They gave him a mechanic called Lake Teleport, allowing him to use water to traverse the map unpredictably.
That sounds terrifying.
And a rage mode, too. And then looking ahead to November, they are adding Art the Clown from the Terrifier films.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He introduces a silent killer trait where he makes zero sound cues, he pulls random weapons from a trash bag, and he forces visual hallucinations onto the other players.
That is wild.
Yeah.
But, you know, the real insight here is why this specific game survives for a decade, while massive $100 million live service games from major publishers like Anthem crash and burn within months.
Right. Why does this indie-turned juggernaut outlast the absolute giants?
It comes down to a highly negotiated trust.
Yeah.
The developers, Behavior Interactive, have managed to secure a continuous pipeline of premium intellectual property, from Stranger Things to Resident Evil to Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
But the analysis warns that the live service model is a very fragile ecosystem. When you introduce mechanics like teleportation or complete auditory silence, you really threaten the illusion of fairness.
Ah, I see.
If the four survivor players feel that a new killer is mathematically impossible to beat, the ecosystem just collapses. The developers have survived a decade because they aggressively patch and balance the game based on community feedback.
So they survived by maintaining absolute trust and fairness with their community.
Exactly.
But what happens when that trust fractures? And not just between a company and its consumers, but between a company and the very people engineering its future.
Yeah.
That brings us to our final topic, and it shifts the tone of our deep dive significantly.
It does, because the broader technology sector is currently facing a crisis that isn't about market share or hardware sales at all. It's about structural morality.
Right. And before we unpack this, we need to be incredibly clear with you listening. Our role here is solely to impartially convey the facts as they are presented in our source material, Tech and Night.
Yes, absolutely.
We are looking at this strictly through the lens of industry mechanics and business impact. We are not taking sides on the underlying geopolitical conflicts, nor are we endorsing the views of the protesters or the corporate boards involved.
Right. Our focus is entirely on how ethical demands are tangibly altering the operational reality of the global tech sector.
Exactly. So on June 14th, at Stanford University's commencement ceremony, approximately 200 students walked out during a speech being delivered by Sundar Pichai,
the CEO of Google and Alphabet.
Yes. They were protesting a specific corporate initiative known as Project Nimbus.
Right. And the sources detail that Project Nimbus is a $1.2 billion joint contract between Google, Amazon, and the Israeli government.
Okay.
The contract provides advanced cloud computing infrastructure and artificial intelligence tools for Israel's military and security apparatus.
And the Take and Night report outlines the two deeply entrenched, conflicting perspectives driving this tension.
Right.
On one side, you have the protesting students, alongside internal employee advocacy groups. They argue that providing this specific technological infrastructure makes these corporations complicit in human rights violations against Palestinians.
Yes.
They are demanding strict tech accountability, basically arguing that the creators of AI must dictate how it is ethically deployed.
Right. And then conversely, from a purely corporate and geopolitical perspective, the contract represents a highly lucrative, strategically critical alliance.
Okay.
For massive global entities like Google and Amazon, securing defense contracts with allied governments is a foundational pillar of their long-term enterprise growth.
But this friction isn't entirely new for Silicon Valley, is it? The sources draw a direct historical line back to 2018.
Yes, to the Project Maven protests.
Right. When Google employees staged massive protests over Project Maven, which was an AI targeting contract with the U.S. Pentagon.
Exactly.
In that instance, Google actually backed away and let the contract expire. But Project Nimbus has remained active despite years of intense internal and external pressure.
It has.
So looking at the scale of these companies, it raises a philosophical question. Can a global tech giant providing foundational internet infrastructure ever truly be a neutral platform? Or is corporate neutrality just a marketing myth at this point?
Well, the analysis suggests that the era of the neutral platform is completely over.
Really?
Yeah, largely due to a massive generational shift in the workforce. We're talking about Gen Z engineers who have grown up completely immersed in social media activism and global connectivity.
That makes sense.
For previous generations, there was often a firewall between personal politics and corporate employment. You built the database and the client decided how to use it.
Right.
But for the incoming workforce, corporate ethics are not a peripheral issue. They are a non-negotiable condition of employment.
But looking at the raw economics, does a walkout of 200 students at a graduation ceremony actually move the needle for a trillion-dollar conglomerate?
It absolutely does, because it represents a severe recruitment bottleneck.
Oh, I see.
The lifeblood of Silicon Valley is entirely dependent on securing top-tier engineering talent. The AI arms race requires highly specific, incredibly rare intellects.
Right, they need the best of the best.
Exactly. So if the brightest minds graduating from elite institutions like Stanford systematically refused to work for companies that hold controversial defense contracts, it fundamentally cripples a company's ability to innovate.
Wow. It is basically an impossible scenario for the executives.
It really is.
Like, if they cancel the government contracts, they anger their shareholders, lose out on billions in guaranteed revenue, and damage strategic geopolitical ties.
Right.
But if they maintain the contracts, they face internal revolts, public walkouts, and they lose the very engineering talent required to build the next generation of artificial intelligence.
The tension is structural. And it is only going to intensify as AI becomes more integrated into global defense systems.
Wow. Well, we have covered some massive shifting ground today.
We really have.
We started with a sealed piece of plastic from 1986 selling for $3 million, which is just a testament to a generation desperately trying to buy back its own history.
Yep.
Then we watched Nintendo completely reconstruct its most cherished legacy to bridge a divide between aging millennials and Gen Z.
Brilliantly, I might add.
Truly. We saw Xbox realize that a brilliant game like Forza can't save a dying hardware delivery model, pushing them toward a cloud-based future. And finally, we looked at how the heaviest moral demands are threatening the talent pipelines of the most powerful tech giants in the world.
Yeah.
The clear through line for you listening to this today is that the digital world is maturing rapidly. The next generation, whether they're evaluating the fairness of a live service horror game or deciding whether to lend their engineering genius to a trillion-dollar corporation, they are intensely scrutinizing what actually holds value and what is ethically acceptable.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on the structural failures we've explored today. If top-tier tech talent begins abandoning the massive Silicon Valley conglomerates over these ethical red lines.
Yeah.
And at the exact same time, massive gaming consoles are losing their dominance to decentralized cloud services. Where does the talent go?
Oh, wow.
Could we be looking at a near future where the most brilliant innovations, you know, the next leap in AI or the next global gaming phenomenon, come entirely from decentralized indie co-ops?
That is wild.
Could the future be built by lean teams of brilliant engineers who operate completely outside of the paralyzed traditional corporate structure?
That is a fascinating idea. When the giants get too slow to pivot or too morally compromised to attract talent, the innovators simply rode around them.
Exactly.
Well, that is all time we have for this deep dive. Keep questioning the technology you use every day. Keep wondering about the hidden systems behind your screens. And we will be right here next time to help you unpack it all.